Hi, everybody. Welcome to Paul Listnick, Behind the Curtain, my opportunity to step away from the, I usually say my opportunity to step away from the worlds of politics and law and come into the world of the arts and theater. Today, we don't quite take that far a step away from the world of politics because we're actually going to be talking about presidents, and I guess that's politics, but it's a different angle to them. It's about presidents and money, their own money. And I found this to be fascinating. Joining me is Megan Gorman. She's the author of a new book called All the President's Money, How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. She appeared on WGN-TV Political Report. I interviewed her as well on our WGN Midday News. It's such an interesting thing. We've rerun the interview over on the TV side. But the good news is, Megan, that you and I get more time to talk on this WGN Radio podcast because there isn't somebody talking in my ear who's telling me to stop after 5 minutes.
Exactly. Well, first of all, Paul, thanks for having me. And it's so good to be chatting with you again. And, you know, it's funny, you said you don't like to talk politics. I think when we talk about the presidents, we're talking about Americana, right? And there's something, it's like the 4th of July. People are very patriotic about their presidents. So we're really talking about that versus the politics of them.
Well, I mean, I think that's true. And listen, you know, talking politics, first of all, it's a dangerous concept, right? You sound like you're on one side or the other and you're always angering somebody. That's really not what we're doing in this interview. We're taking a look at this group of 45 people, different people who have taken up 47 slots, but 45 people who have served in this office. And again, what I found fascinating about your book is that this isn't a matter of, and I want our viewers and listeners, we're both, to understand, this isn't just about how the president's handled the United States Treasury or the influence they had on. No, this is about how they did with their own money. I think it's fascinating. Let's let our viewers and listeners understand your background because you've got the perfect background for doing this. So fill everybody in. You are a wealth management expert.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I've loved the president since I was five. I'm like, that's the books I'm drawn to in the library when I read. And I'm a tax attorney by training. I spent 12 years at Goldman Sachs. Briefly was at Bank of New York Mellon, which was Alexander Hamilton's firm. And then 10 years ago, I launched my own firm. And so I work with very wealthy people on all facets of their finances, from taxes, estate planning, investing, cash flow. And I would tell you that my job is, you know, probably 30% numbers and 70% psychology. So when you take my background and working with people and understanding how they've made money and how they've achieved the American financial dream, it was sort of interesting to apply those tenets or those skills that I see in my clients to the presidents. And to your point, this isn't about what they did in office, because what I found is they could be very good presidents financially in office, but behind the scenes, not so great, right? And vice versa. So it's really about understanding them as people. And what I found also in looking at the presidents is starting from Washington to Trump today, they tell the story of the worries, the anxieties, the issues that Americans face every day in trying to be financially resilient. And that's what's fascinating.
On television, I'd have to move on. But yes. Here, I'm not going to move on to love. Let me take a step back. Because I also want our viewers and listeners to understand that we're really talking about them. That we're learning from the presidents. But you work with, I guess I shouldn't say everyday people, but you're working with regular folks who have their own monies to be that they're concerned with. And so when you say 70% psychological, I assume that's true for all of us, right? What does that mean? I mean, are you saying that whether I have just a little money or a lot of money, it's really about, well, I guess I won't put words in your mouth. What is that 70% referring to?
Yeah. So money is emotion, right? Think about how anxious money can make you feel. You know, money at times can make you feel good. It can make you feel bad. But anxiety and making the right decisions is something that everybody struggles with, whether you are the wealthiest person in the world or just an average, everyday American trying to succeed, right? But what I would tell you is when you look at the presidents, a lot of them had the same money anxieties. And when you look at them over the course of history, let's take Abraham Lincoln, for example. You know, out of the gate, grew up poor. He goes and as soon as he gets away from his father, because remember, in the U.S., until you were 21, your father always could have a say in where your money went. He goes to New Salem. And in New Salem, he decides to have a business. has no background to have a business, takes on debt to do it, takes on a not a great partner. They expand the business, they overbuy inventory, and the business goes belly up, and his partner, proceeds to do the best thing for the partner, which is drop dead. So Lincoln is sitting there with debt, and he calls it his national debt. And it's about $1,100, right? You think about that in today's money, it's about $40,000 today.
Oh, that's big time.
And
Okay.
what's fascinating about it is Lincoln stumbles again and again, and yet is always able to pivot and find a way over time to not just pay off the debt, but become financially successful. And he becomes a saver. He builds up a substantial asset base. At the time of his death, he's worth $85,000 or about $2 million in our money. And what you found is that in the past, people could make mistakes and still succeed financially. Now, what I mean by that is we propel to today, people are coming out of college, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt or even more, right? So they're already feeling the stress of the decision-making they made at 18. And now every financial decision has to pivot off of that debt. And so when you think about money being emotion, it's hard to make good financial decisions when you've got debt weighing down on you and every decision matters on you doing it perfectly. And so when I'm working with clients, a lot of times the answers are in books. It's about getting them to talk, getting them to explain to me what's really going on, what's stressing you out. Why do you feel that this is not the right decision? Or why do you feel so strongly that this is the right decision? And if I do my job correctly, I'm merely a mirror that lets them see themselves a little more accurately. And I think that's important for all people in managing their money.
Is there, in doing a comparison again, taking the presidents, looking at our own lives, is there a through line to anybody before the president who is influenced by their spouse or their partner, their kids, family issues, other relevant issues like that are life issues? And then we take a president and put that person in office, and now they're worried about the minorities and the majorities and the red states and the blue states and it's not about their spouse or partner there. That person might be there, but they're also surrounded by generals and economic advisors and the best of the best. I guess what I'm saying is there a through line between the personal decisions we make for our own lives and then a president who did that earlier part of their life, but now they're making bigger decisions which is influencing them? Or is that president that same person that they always were? There's just more people involved, more considerations involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are the same as again in life, in situation after situation. I think there have been presidents whose personal skills in finance pulls into the presidential space. So I'll give you a really good example is Warren G. Harding, right? Now he always
Everybody's favorite.
everyone's favorite, right? But always ranks at the bottom of, the presidential rankings. Not a great president. If I ask most Americans, they probably would tell you he Teapot Dome scandal, and I'm in San Francisco today, that he died down the street at the Palace Hotel. So we knew he wasn't a great president. But when you carve into his finances, early on, he was an entrepreneur. He was like a Zuckerberg or a Musk today, right? He gets into the newspaper business, which in the late 1800s is a huge field. It's like AI today. And he buys a newspaper for $300 with a couple of friends. He ends up buying them out and he grows this newspaper and he's innovative. He comes up with interesting ideas like we should only advertise snow shovels in the winter and the fall, not the summer, right? And he grows this newspaper and he's incredibly successful. And then he also makes it that his employees can become owners. And his employees love him, right? I mean, they call him WG. He's really about growing his business, their wealth. And then he gets to the presidency and he's very laissez-faire, just like he was in running the newspaper. And the same skills that made him a very good boss and a very good entrepreneur and grower of business makes him a horrible president because he's not able to judge some of his cabinet members and the people surrounding him correctly. Okay, so
That's it.
that's one of those situations where the skill set works personally, not so much in the presidential space. I think one president who does a really good job of translating themselves from the personal to the public, I would tell you, is Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan, I was very touched by his personal story. And I don't know, Paul, if you know much about Reagan's.
I've interviewed his daughter. Yes, I do.
Yeah, okay, you do. So grows up poor. And the father's a shoe salesman back when department stores were the cutting edge stores in America. And his father is tragically an alcoholic. Reagan always knew it was a disease, but his father would get his paycheck. And as his father would go walk home, he would spend the money at all the bars and there'd be no paycheck. So Reagan grows up struggling, learns to be a budgeter from his mother, a very pious woman who has a lot of side hustles. But Reagan sort of attaches himself to people in his life, like Lou Wasserman, his girlfriend's father, who is a well-known pastor, who were able to create visions, right? Able to create aspiration in him. And I bring this up because one of the things that you think about in the Reagan era, regardless of the policies, is when he spoke to Americans, he created that aspirational financial dream of what America should be. And I think he translated what he did with himself in motivating himself financially to try to bring that home to the American public. So he's a more of an example where it worked for him. But again, it's very hit or miss.
Yeah, and by the way, if you probably have seen Max Boot's biography of Reagan. I had Max on our midday show a few
Did you?
weeks
Okay,
back, and
it's on my bedside table. So it, yeah, I'm looking
yeah,
forward
he's
to it.
it's pretty definitive. I think you'll find that. And my I'm just plugging my podcast interview with Patty Reagan, his daughter, also pretty fascinating. We launched that a couple of weeks ago, and she has very interesting views on her mother and her father. She's tougher on her mother than she is on her father.
Yeah,
But anyway, back to the
not
presidents, what we're dealing with.
surprised.
You know, I actually got a couple of comments after our interview aired with people saying, "You didn't talk about Biden. You didn't talk about Trump." And of course, part of that was because we were taking a more global look at your book, and you deal with all the presidents. And I have to ask you the question that I ask you every time I interview you, which is, who was the best at managing money? Because that continues to be a big surprise for me.
And it's
But
not Biden, and it's not Trump.
and it's neither of them. But for those people who I think were maybe disappointed that I didn't ask you about that, I said, well, we're going to be doing a podcast. I will ask. So let's talk about our current president, Donald Trump, because it's sort of he's famously known for several bankruptcies and bankrupting casinos and people who are Trump detractors will say you can't possibly bankrupt a casino. How did he ever do it? What is your view on Trump and the way, again, we're not talking about the federal budget people, we're talking about his personal finances and his
Personal
life.
finance. So first of all, I would tell anyone, Trump is a lot like clients I work with, right? Trump is generational wealth. So when you work with these people, they look at the world very differently than somebody who's self-made with their money. Donald Trump is generation two. So his father, Fred, was generation one. He's gen two. We obviously know the gen threes, Ivanka and Donald Jr. and Tiffany and
Eric.
Barron. And Eric, I can't forget Eric. And then obviously there's the G4s who we don't know as well, but they're the children of his children. When you are working with generational wealth, the first thing you have to think about is they're not thinking about their wealth. They're thinking about how do I push it down generation after generation. So I bring this up because when you carve into some of his finances that we've been able to see, you are seeing estate planning being done. And his estate planning being done is very sophisticated, right? We're seeing grats, right? The use of transfer, right? So I bring this up because where Donald Trump probably differs from a lot of wealthy people is when we do certain types of estate planning techniques, we'll take discounts and valuations to maybe take a $20 million asset and get it down to 12 million. Okay. What he takes it is he takes it, he goes even further. He's very unafraid of risk and he's unafraid of consequences. And so this is what differs from him from a lot of other people. Because when the New York Times did their scrutiny on his finances, he did a lot of very common legal estate planning techniques. He just pushed the envelope. And this is where it's really interesting is the Internal Revenue Service, or the service as we call it, right? They audited him. But even when they audited him, they weren't even that pushy with him in sort of pulling back a lot of his discounting. Now, at the same time, I think the other thing with Trump is he has just decided he's not going to do what everybody else does, right? So, as we've been going to, we're looking at what's going on right now. I'll give you a good example. Truth Social, right? The stock that he is basically a founder of and he owns a large percentage of. I work with corporate CEOs, CFOs. When you are working with people who are tied to publicly traded stock, you don't sell, you don't make comments to the public. You typically try not to do anything that could move the stock. Trump has moved it to a revocable trust that is being held with the trustee that's his son, Donald Jr. And I bring this up because it looks optically like he's being arm's length. But it's a lot of smoke and mirrors here. A revocable trust is really a very, convoluted way of saying it's a trust that the grantor, in this case, Donald Trump, President Trump, could change the trust at any time. So he still has control. And he also has his son as the trustee. Now, the relationship there is not arm's length. And therefore, this is not really taking an asset and putting it aside and letting someone else manage it while you have conflicts of interest. And I bring this up because I'll give you a quick example. Lyndon B. Johnson, when he became president, owned radio stations and television stations. Now, there's a
Well, did
lot
he own
of
them or did Lady Bird?
he exactly. Lady Bird owned them. She bought them with her separate property from before her marriage because her mother died when she was a very little girl. But obviously, there's influence, right? They got influence becoming one of the biggest radio and TV stations in Austin, Texas. But on the day after Kennedy shot, Lady Bird is approached by the advisors and they're telling her to sell the radios and TV stations. She talks about this in her diary. And Lady Bird and Lyndon Johnson decide to do something called a blind trust. Now we know blind trusts today because they're a little more common, but back then they were not required to do a blind trust. But they decide to set up a blind trust and they use three attorneys who are not affiliated with them, who they had an arm's length relationship with, to manage the trust. And really, the only thing that they kept control of was like a municipal bond portfolio. The Johnsons had tons of bonds. And I bring this up because, they ended up holding the radio and TV stations throughout the presidency. The daughter sold it in the early 2000s for nine figures. But they really did try to have an arm's length management of it, where they didn't have control, where they weren't talking to the people on a daily basis. So very different from what Trump has set up. Now, what's more analogous to Trump is the recently deceased Jimmy Carter. Now, Jimmy Carter, we think of as this sainted angel type president. Jimmy Carter,
History has
very,
treated
very
him well in
firm.
his death.
But very firm opinions and was very stubborn. And Jimmy Carter had built this family fortune on the farms and the warehouses after his father died. And if you go into the newspaper articles from the 1976 election, poor Gerry Ford is getting picked on because he's worth a couple hundred thousand dollars. And Carter's got this empire. So Carter puts it in a blind trust, but he does it all wrong. He picks an advisor to be the trustee who he sees regularly. And he gives Billy Carter way too much control. And it's never arm's length enough. And when he actually leaves office, he's $1 million in debt. So I bring this up because I think what you see from Johnson to Carter to Trump is that these types of vehicles don't work anymore. We are at an inflection point in this country where we need a better way for our political leaders, not just the presidents, but the congresspeople as well, to basically, when they're in office, put their assets aside and have no control. And I say this looking at members of Congress who've made a ton of money while they're in office. It just makes the American public lose trust. The Pew Research Center has studied this nonstop. Americans believe people become politicians because they want to make money. And that's a big problem with what Donald Trump is setting up with his asset base. So going to your question on the bankruptcy, because I don't want to forget that, I think he's just very cavalier and he believes with the consequences, he'll find a way around them. And that's a very interesting money attitude.
So two follow-ups on that. First one, if you, I don't think you were Trump's advisor before he became president. If you were, I'll
I
stop
have not worked
asking
with
that.
any of the presidents.
Okay. So my question is, if he had hypothetically come to you prior to being president, would you, as a wealth advisor, would you have, knowing this is somebody who, risk is no limit, would you have said, Donald, don't go there. It's not, I can't advise that. Or would you say, hey man, you, this is who you are. Do it. So now it's a general comment about you and your clients. Is it a you be you or is it a be careful?
So here's the thing. Donald Trump likes to surprise at times. So what I would tell him is this: this is low-hanging fruit to maybe win more support. And why I mean that is, what if you were to set up an independent family office staffed by people you do not know, and you move all the assets to them during your
Well,
presidency?
he
And you
wouldn't trust
got
that.
involved. Pardon?
He wouldn't trust that.
But here's the thing: he wants the American public to like him. Donald
Yeah.
Trump wants to be liked very much, right? He's a very he wants to feel loved. If you listen to what he writes sometimes, there's this need to be loved by him in a very different
Yeah.
way. Eisenhower didn't feel that way, right? Very different
Right.
presidents, right? But I would say to him, look, if you want to build the trust with the American public and actually maybe win people over, right? What is the problem with setting up an independent financial office? And you have the pick of the land, right? You have the you could hire the best of the best to do this. And it's for 4 years. And you get yourself out of it. You're not involved in it because people will even if people don't like you, they will respect that about you. And that's something that's really important with the American public.
A second thought. Oh, by the way, you triggered another need for a plug for me. I'll be talking with David Rubenstein
Oh.
on our show on his book, The Highest Calling, which if you haven't read that, again, interviews about
Oh,
all the presidents, you will like
he
it.
is such a steward of history. What he has done in preserving some of our documents, it's amazing. And I hope people realize that when they see things in these museums, a lot of it is influenced by his ability to save these documents for us.
And like you, comes from the world of wealth management. I mean, so there's some kind of tie there somewhere between those
Right.
worlds. But I'll be talking to David soon. So back to this, my second off the Trump question, which is, if that's the way you view life, and again, there's a lot about that people seem to like about Trump. It is that non-standard kind of guy. But then you become president. If they brought in a private wealth advisor to the presidency, would you say you got to be more careful because we're now talking about the country? Or again, do you see the through line and say, hey, it's worked for you in your private life, so let's see how it works for you here in the public life?
No, I would tell him I would want it to be completely partitioned off with a family office set up and completely arm's length. I think it is the best thing for the American public. And the reason I say this is I go back to George Washington. And George Washington, we always talk about, he set the standard, right? He set the 2 terms. He set how you behave doing certain things as president. And he was very mindful of his reputation. It was something he was aware of. And he always knew that money could make things tricky. Now, Washington had a very big asset base, but incredibly illiquid. He owned a lot of land, he owned a lot of slaves. And there were times in his career where he was being offered money for something. So I'll give you an example. In 1795, Commonwealth of Virginia comes to him and says, "We are so appreciative. We know you're the president. We're so appreciative of everything you've done. Here's $20,000 of the James River Canal Company stock." Now, they give it to him, and this could have solved a lot of Washington's illiquidity problems at Mount Vernon. But Washington knew if he took it, it would sully how the American public saw him. And so what he did is he ended up, Henry Lighthorse Lee helped him with this. They set up this ability for Virginia schools to apply for the money. And a school wins it, the Liberty Hall Academy. He donates the shares to them. They change it to the Washington Academy. And 67 years later, it becomes Washington and Lee. And today, some of that original money that Washington put there is still funding students that are in school today. I think it's
Wow.
$1.87 for every student there. But Washington was really clear if he took the money, as much as he needed it for liquidity, it would really break that bond that he had with the American public. And so I would point that out. That to Trump and to anyone else who takes office is follow Washington's example. There's nothing wrong with doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And it ends up, if he did it, think of all the noise that would come down. It'd be one level of the noise in the media that we wouldn't have to deal with. And everybody is exhausted.
Yeah.
Now, I want to get back to your question on Biden because I want to
Well,
talk about.
I haven't asked that one
Oh,
yet,
you
so
haven't?
let me
Okay. I know he's
because
just
but
left
it is where I
office.
was going. But
Yeah.
first I wanted to note in the Rubenstein book where he sort of says that but for Washington for a decision years later to bury him at Mount Vernon because he was to be buried underneath the dome of the Capitol and
Yep.
didn't happen, that Mount Vernon would not have survived financially. But now of course it becomes a key point in Washington. Plug for Rubenstein. But back
Yeah,
to you,
no, and
yes.
he's right. And by the way, Washington was afraid of being buried alive. So they had him lay out there for 3 days to make
Yeah,
sure.
I'm kind of afraid of that too. So would you?
But I think in Washington's day, it probably was a real issue.
Yeah, it might. Well, they gave him little bells, right? They could ring them from below the
From
earth. They
inside.
still have those. Yeah, you see those graves in Boston. But anyway, so now, yes, let's go to Biden because talk about a difference in personalities. You know, Trump. While he cares about his family, I think most people would say it's about his business, it's about all of that. For Joe Biden, I don't think anybody could tell you, other than his service to the country and his family, what matters to him. So, how did his view of how he dealt with his personal finances, and yet today I realize the Biden detractors, go after him for a variety of reasons, but let's talk about facts here. So, again, talk about how he managed his money early on, where he ends up in this process now that he's out of the White House.
Biden, it's interesting because a lot of the Biden policies target the middle class, and he talks about being middle class a lot. But when Biden was born, he was actually born to a family that was quite wealthy. His father was in manufacturing during World War II. And after the war, the manufacturing fell apart and the family fell in social status. And so really went from, being on like yachts to being in Scranton, Pennsylvania, living with the family, trying to scrounge. So I think that had a big imprint on Biden. And Biden is someone who, he is not as organized financially as one would want, and he's easily swayed. I think if I worked with him, he's one of those clients, and this often happens, don't laugh, and I'm an attorney, so I can say this. Attorneys are often the hardest clients to have because they don't want to take all the advice. They think they know better. And I see the little bit of
We
that in Joe Biden.
do. As an attorney, we do know better.
Yes, we do know better, right? But I think with Biden, and I talk about this in the book is, when you have trauma that happens, and I bring this up because obviously the fires happened last month in California, and this is what a lot of these people are going to go through. You are not good at decision making after a trauma because there's just your brain fires differently. And so I think with Biden coming from a background where they fell in socioeconomic status, they had the trauma of the death of his first wife and child. I think it made Biden not a great financial decision maker. And this is where it catches him today. I think he's overindulgent with his children. Now, a lot of people are overindulgent with their children, right? But if I said that, I think most Americans would be like, yeah, he's overindulgent with his children to a fault. And so as a result, I think when it comes to his kids, he has a bit of a blinder in not thinking about what would this look like on the cover of the Wall Street Journal or on Fox News. He doesn't think that through. And I'll give you an example that got him sort of caught up. In 2018, they've talked about the fact that there's all these loans between him and his brother James. Okay. Now I can tell you, in working with high net worth, we make loans to family members all the time. Now, the IRS does not give you a clear-cut test. You have to rebut the presumption of a gift, okay? Has to be a loan document, has to have an interest rate, okay? So you can use what's called the applicable federal rates that the IRS gives us monthly. Has to have a payment schedule. You have to report the interest, right? There's a whole list of things you do. So the loan made to his brother was, I think, $240,000. So a loan that's over $100,000, you can't suspend the interest. They have to pay it. So it's a short-term loan. He makes it interest-free. And what this makes it look like, because there's no note, or we've never seen a note, because he didn't have him pay interest, it didn't appear on the tax return. The interest is a gift, but the interest wouldn't have been much. You had someone who took something that a lot of people do to help family members and executed on it in a sloppy manner that anyone who's looking for something to throw at him can make it look nefarious. He's just sloppy. He made a loan, he made a below market loan to his brother, very common in high net worth. He just didn't document it the right way. And that's where he makes mistakes. And so I don't think he's done anything nefarious when it comes to Hunter. I think he's just very overindulgent. Now, Hunter Biden, that's a whole other story. And that's not for
But he's
this
not a
podcast.
president, so we're not going to talk
He's
about.
not a president, but I'll tell you this. He's not the first presidential child who's had a lot of drama with this. God help presidential children. It's not fun. And one presidential child who I give a lot of credit to is Jenna Hager, or Jenna Bush Hager, who's on the Today Show. She's very much a Bush in the sense that the Bushes, whether it was HWW, her, they all have to find their own way with money. And she's done a good job of that. So I give
Yeah,
her credit.
so did Robert Lincoln, who became a partner in Isham, Lincoln, and Beale. Every time I lecture in my bar review lectures, I always say, yeah, it's that Lincoln.
At Lincoln. Although don't invite him to anything if you're the president, because there's always an assassination going
Oh my
on.
God, yeah, we don't want
Right?
that. So we just have a few minutes left, and look, I'm gonna say we've told the Herbert Hoover story in several times. Somebody must have watched our interview because I was on the air. I don't know what I was talking about, but I must have brought Herbert Hoover up. I don't even remember. And you know, and not in the way that you and I have talked about him, but it led somebody to send me a comment on Twitter to let me know that Hoover was actually very successful in his younger days. And I thought, okay, jerk, you saw the interview that I did with Megan. Good for you. Thank you. And you heard me talk about Hoover on TV in a completely unrelated way, but you needed to let me know that you're now a Herbert Hoover expert. So with my tip of the cap to whoever that viewer was, very briefly, because I'd rather do other things, very briefly, just say Herbert Hoover is surprising because the national economy tanks while he's president, but he himself was incredibly generous and incredibly wealthy.
Yes. And it's funny, I think he's a good example of not all people are good or bad. There's a nuance, right? Hoover had bad luck of becoming president when he became president. And I don't think he had never served in government, really. He was Secretary of Commerce earlier on, but he really didn't know how to work the government the same way as other presidents have. But I think with Herbert Hoover, he's very good at knowing how to budget, managing his grit. He married the right person and he was really giving with his money. And it's partly because he grew up as a Quaker. So he grew up with the Quaker community teaching these beliefs that money really wasn't just for oneself. It was about giving back. And so you see this over the course of his life, including going over to Europe twice to save Europe from famine in both World War I and World War II. So Hoover, I think, is, not a great president, but was a great person in terms of really trying to do the right things for people and caring.
So
And I think, yeah.
let's come off of that in kind of a general comment, because people who read your book, and I don't know how many copies I've sold of your book, because people, every time they hear me talk about it, they're fascinated. And I
I
know I
know,
have
and
to,
it's
I'm get,
still selling.
yes. And this, I've got to get a copy. I've got a copy. And I know it was also listed on, there was a series of books of presidents people need to read. You're one of them. So I'm sure we have a lot of people watching this. But that being said, you make the point in the book, because this isn't a book just for presidents, right? It's not a matter if you're going to be president, read the book. You make the point in the book that American presidents are just like us. They have the same, certainly before they get to office, they have this, they're ordinary people. They worry about their own money. They worry about their own security, their own budgets. They're pursuing the American dream like we all are. So my question is, while none of us except 45 people to date have reached the pinnacle that they have reached, for people who read your book who are just good old ordinary citizens, meaning non-presidents,
Yes.
what do we take from the book for our own lives? What is the message of the book for the rest of us?
Yeah. So look, I want people to understand that having financial resilience, which is actually the goal of financial education, is to be able to weather the ups and downs of your financial life, that it's really hard, that it's constantly going to be managing decisions the right way, and understanding if you make a bad decision, you have to pivot fast. And I want people to understand that people have always struggled with this, right? Jefferson struggled with budgeting. You see Theodore Roosevelt dealing with
By
the
the way, I got
fact
to tell you, I'm sorry. I learned from
that
your book. I always
yeah.
thought Jefferson, he had lots of major financial issues.
Hot money mess. Him, Madison, Monroe. But what I would tell you is it's always been hard over the course of American history. But today it feels like it's never been harder. And I think the challenge is some of the institutions that used to be more nimble have gotten harder to work around. Getting an education, buying a house, right? Buying a house is going to get even harder now with insurance. All of these things are these boulders that keep coming up to the average American, not counting for the fact that the price of eggs is incredibly expensive. And so people are frustrated because before you could make a mistake and survive it. Today, it's almost like you have to be perfect. And I want people to understand that they're not crazy. It is really hard. So financial literacy, financial education is a constant thing. Whether you hire a financial planner, libraries in this country offer great financial education programs, but always look to keep educating yourself on how to manage your money.
So important. Megan, people who want to reach you, if you don't mind, what's the best way for them to reach out
Yeah.
you?
You can find me at allthepresidentsmoney.com, or I'm on Instagram at allthepresidentsmoney. And my firm is called Checkers Financial, and that's with a Q, named after Churchill's house. And you can find me there as well.
Not after the Nixon dog.
No, not at all.
Megan Gorman, the book is All the President's Money, How the Men Who Governed America Governed Their Money. A great book. I'm so glad we had all these opportunities to talk about it. Congratulations to you. It's a great book, and look forward to the next one.